It's 1988 at the Pixar offices in Marin County, California. Steve Jobs and Pixar president Ed Catmull step into Ed's office. Steve and Ed have just come from a meeting with several Pixar animators. They asked Steve for $300,000 to make a new short film. Steve told them no and walked out of the room without even hearing their pitch. He has no intention of changing his mind. "Ed, I said everything I needed to say in there."
"I know, but I'd still like to talk it over with you."
Ed is 10 years older than Steve, and he exudes calm in almost every situation. Ed's demeanor can make people feel like they're talking to a friendly professor, not a company president. Steve has grown to respect Ed, and he always enjoys their conversations, even when they disagree.
"Pixar is bleeding money, Ed."
"I know that. I just slashed the budget. I'm not going to approve $300,000 for another short film." Ed smiles. Steve furrows his brow.
"What?"
"Don't take this the wrong way, Steve, but you have an incredible ability to upset people."
"And why would they be upset? This isn't personal, it's business."
But they're not businessmen, Steve. They're creatives. I've watched you sit in rooms with powerful people, and you can match any of them. But not every meeting is with powerful people, and you don't seem to get that. It's worth thinking about who's on the other side of the table from you."
After giving up his dreams of becoming an artist, Ed started to view management as an art form. And he believes Steve can grow into a brilliant leader, but he knows that one of Steve's greatest weaknesses is a lack of empathy for his employees. Ed hopes to change that.
"Steve, these people work hard, and they're passionate about what they do. They're not trying to pull anything over on you. They're not trying to make some power play. They're asking for help."
"Ed, I've sunk close to $50 million of my own money into this company. And every time I come here, you ask me for more."
"I understand that, too. And I'm not trying to tell you what to do. I'm asking you to keep an open mind. I love what the animators do with their short films, but it's not my priority. And I'm not going to sit in a room and act like it is."
Since purchasing Pixar from George Lucas in 1986, Steve has focused on selling Pixar's graphic systems and using the technology as a component in his next computers. He's supported the animation team's short films, but they've always been an afterthought.
"I know you're a hardware and software guy, Steve. We all know that. But I think it's at least worth listening to their pitch. Lasseter's got something with this one. I think it could be bigger than Luxo Jr."
Steve was with Pixar animator John Lasseter when he debuted his short film Luxo Jr. at a conference in Dallas. That film introduced the computer-animated lamp that would eventually become Pixar's iconic logo. Steve loved the film, and he took an almost instant liking to John Lasseter and his ideas.
"Well, are there storyboards?"
"There are. And let me tell you, they're going to blow you away."
After their chat, Ed led Steve down to the animation studio to hear John Lasseter's pitch. Lasseter began by telling Steve how much he loved old toys. Lasseter, a master storyteller, laid out his vision for a short film called Tin Toy, a story about a toy named Tinny who lives in fear of a baby. Lasseter's storyboards were brilliant, and so was his performance. He acted out all of the roles with dramatic flair and funny voices. Steve was floored. After the pitch, he agreed to give Lasseter and his team the money they needed. He had only one request. "All I ask of you, John, is to make it great." After the meeting, Steve turned his focus back to his computer company. But Next was not destined to be the next big thing Steve hoped it would be. Though he didn't know it at the time, by heeding Ed Catmull's advice and greenlighting John Lasseter's film, Steve was setting Pixar on a course to change the face of animation and go head-to-head with one of the biggest brands in the world of entertainment, Disney.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is Business Movers. On March 29, 1989, Tin Toy won the Academy Award for Best Short Animated Film. When the Tin Toy team returned to the Bay Area, Steve took them all out to one of his favorite vegetarian restaurants to celebrate. At one point in the evening, John Lasseter grabbed the Oscar, raised it up, and gave a toast to Steve Jobs, exclaiming, "You asked me to make it great. There you go." At the party, Steve was able to put his concerns about Next aside for a short time. But Steve had plenty of reason to worry. After its successful launch, Next was struggling. Its price point of $6,500 per computer was higher than most of the competition, and the potential clients in higher education Steve had targeted were looking elsewhere. Many doubted that Next could bounce back, and some already thought Steve's career was on a downward swing. Steve was forced to come to grips with a tough reality. Next was not going to be the success he'd dreamed of. But Tin Toy gave Steve hope that Pixar might be his chance for redemption. Winning an Oscar gave Steve a boost of confidence. It was a tangible success he could show off to his detractors, but it also helped him see that Pixar was at the forefront of computer animated movies and that the company he owned had the ability to change the film industry. But Steve knew if he was going to make Pixar work, he'd have to find a way to make the company financially viable. And in a bit of a reversal, for Steve, that meant fully committing to Pixar's animation department. At Pixar, Steve would take Ed Catmull's advice to heart. He would focus on building an environment where his team of creatives could thrive. He would work to treat them with respect and earn their trust and loyalty. And Steve would need all the loyal soldiers he could muster, because Pixar was about to come up against Disney, a company that had crushed almost every challenger in the world of animation. But in the midst of this struggle, Steve's newfound commitment to his employees would pay off in ways he couldn't yet imagine. This is the second episode in our four-part series on Steve Jobs, The Other Side of the Table. It's spring of 1991 at Pixar headquarters. John Lasseter knocks on the door of Ed Catmull's office.
Yeah, come in.
Lasseter steps inside. Despite his jovial appearance and bright Hawaiian shirt, Lasseter is stressed out. Since he won the Academy Award for Tin Toy, Disney hasn't stopped calling. They desperately want Lasseter to come work for them, and the decision is weighing on him.
Ed, Disney called again.
Peter Schneider, the one and only.
Peter Schneider is the president of Walt Disney Features Animation Department, and he's not the only bigwig at Disney who wants Lasseter to direct for them. Disney CEO Michael Eisner and chairman of Walt Disney Studios Jeffrey Katzenberg have also been giving Lasseter the full court press.
Are you hoping I'll talk you into taking the job or talk you out of it, John?
Well, I don't know. I know it would mean money and security, but Steve's been loyal to me. He's given me the chance to do the type of things that Disney fired me for when I was younger.
It's true. Lasseter started his career in animation at Disney, but he struggled to fit in. When they fired him, Lasseter believed it was because he was pushing the studio to move more toward computer animation. Lasseter now credits Steve Jobs as the man who allowed him to spread his wings.
John, you know we want you here, but I'm not going to tell you to pass on a job that could benefit you and your family. I'm just going to ask you what it is you want to do.
If I go to Disney, I can make movies. But if I stay at Pixar, I think I can make history. I'm ready to make my next film.
A feature?
Yes, Ed. I'm just worried we don't have the resources to get it done.
Steve Jobs is now fully committed to the animated side of Pixar, and he believes in the company's potential. But Pixar is facing major financial issues that Steve is working to address. Steve has already cut payroll and reduced the number of employees from 120 to 42. He has also secured advertising work for Pixar with brands like Pillsbury and Volkswagen.
And he's even licensed some of Pixar's technology to Disney. But the job cuts and new revenue streams still aren't enough to make Pixar viable. With money running out, Lasseter fears it might be impossible to make the feature film he has in his head.
Well, John, Steve supported your work on the short films the whole time. I think he'll get behind a feature.
Yeah, but getting behind something and being able to finance it are two entirely different things, Ed. We don't even know if we can survive, let alone make a movie. A feature would take a lot of money. I mean, like Disney money. But just then, Lasseter gets an idea.
Ooh, yeah, Disney money. Ed, what if I tell Peter Schneider that if Disney wants to work with me, they have to make a movie with Pixar?
Ed's eyes narrow, but he likes the idea. If Lasseter can pull this off, it would allow him to make the first full-length computer-animated film in history and hopefully save Pixar in the process. But Ed knows there's a major hurdle they have to clear before they can even attempt what Lasseter is suggesting.
Yeah.
But let's go talk to Steve.
You think we can convince him?
Steve wants Pixar to succeed, and he wants to change the world. Let's show him that this is the way he can do both.
After meeting with Ed Catmull, John Lasseter would once again find himself pitching a movie about toys to Steve Jobs. But unlike Tin Toy, this project would compete with the biggest feature films in Hollywood. Lasseter's idea for his first feature was the genesis of what would eventually become the animated classic Toy Story. Lasseter believed his film could change animated movies forever. Steve loved the vision for the film and Lasseter's ideas about the future of the industry. And like Lasseter, Steve wanted to make something historic. Steve understood that in order for that to happen, they needed Disney. So he gave Lasseter the go-ahead. Lasseter called Peter Schneider with an ultimatum. If Disney wanted to work with him, they would have to do a movie with Pixar and strike a deal with Steve Jobs. Lasseter and Ed Catmull had no idea how Schneider would react. Schneider, like most Disney executives, had a reputation for making demands, not acquiescing to them. But to Ed's surprise, Schneider immediately summoned him to his offices at Disney. Schneider told Ed that he wanted to work on a Pixar film created by John Lasseter, but Schneider was not the decision maker at Disney. For the project to go forward, Jeffrey Katzenberg would have to sign off. Katzenberg had arrived at Disney in the mid-80s when the animation giant was struggling to produce successful feature-length animated films. Katzenberg and his team quickly revived that division of Disney with the creation of The Little Mermaid in 1989. And Katzenberg was confident their next release, Beauty and the Beast, would be an even bigger hit. So when it came time for Jeffrey Katzenberg to meet with Steve Jobs, Katzenberg believed Disney had all of the power in the negotiations. And whether Steve Jobs would admit it or not, he believed it too. Despite Pixar's disadvantages, though, Steve went into negotiations with Katzenberg with several clear demands and goals for his company. He wanted Disney to fully fund production of Toy Story, and he wanted to secure a long-term partnership between the two companies. The negotiations were long and heated, and Jobs and Katzenberg frequently butted heads. John Lasseter, who sat in on some of the meetings between Steve and Katzenberg, said it was like watching two master swordsmen fight a duel. But as negotiations stretched out over months, it became clear that Katzenberg had the luxury of time and Steve did not. Even with some revenue coming in, Pixar was heading for financial collapse. If Steve was going to save his company, he had to get Katzenberg to cut a deal. Whether the choice was conscious or not, Steve treated negotiations with Katzenberg and Disney differently than he might have in the past. In his early days of Next, Steve had often refused to acknowledge that anyone in the room had more power than he did. And if he found himself in a position of weakness, he would often blow up the deal rather than strike a compromise. But that was the old Steve Jobs. In his meetings with Katzenberg, the new Steve Jobs showed restraint and forethought. Steve knew Disney could save Pixar. And once Pixar was stable, Steve believed he could help grow it into something far bigger than most imagined. So Steve made concessions to Disney when it came to video revenue, product licensing, and other aspects of the deal. But Steve got plenty in return. In May of 1991, he secured full financing from Disney for production of Toy Story with a budget of roughly $17 million. He also secured Pixar 12.5% of ticket revenue and two future movies with Disney. In addition to that, Steve would have the power of Disney's distribution and marketing operations behind the film. The deal with Disney saved Pixar,
and it put Steve Jobs and John Lasseter on a path to make history. As production on Toy Story got underway, Steve would find himself observing a creative process unlike anything he'd witnessed before, and he would continue to evolve into a more supportive leader who could get the best work out of his team. Steve loved watching Toy Story take shape, but he decided to stay out of the way when it came to creative input. Steve was there to support his team and help them if they needed it, but he left the creation of the piece to Lasseter and the animators. This marked a huge step in the growth of Steve Jobs as a leader. He was willing to give up control to more qualified experts. This was something Steve had struggled with at Apple and that he'd barely even attempted at Next. But just because Steve wasn't controlling all aspects of the project didn't mean he wasn't involved. Steve witnessed firsthand how grueling the process of writing and animating a film could be. He watched as the Toy Story team took their failures and tried to build from them. And when the failures started to bring the team down, Steve swooped in to pick them back up. He made the process about moving forward, not dwelling on things that went wrong. With his Pixar team, Steve was more positive and excited than perhaps at any other point in his professional career. But Steve could still bring the hammer down when he needed to, and he would. As Toy Story moved forward, Jeffrey Katzenberg and Disney kept giving the Pixar animators notes on the film. One of Disney's main pushes was for Lasseter to make Toy Story's lead character, a toy cowboy named Woody, more edgy. Every time Lasseter and his people showed Disney their progress, Disney pushed them to make Woody more sarcastic and cynical. It got so bad that when Tom Hanks came in to voice Woody, all he could say about the character was, "This guy's a real jerk." It wasn't remotely how Lasseter had envisioned his film, but he kept following Disney's lead. The Pixar team finished a cut of Toy Story in November of 1993. They had made the film that Katzenberg and Disney leadership had pushed them to make. But when the Disney executives watched it, they were baffled. After the screening, Katzenberg asked point blank, "Why is this so terrible?" One Disney executive saw the problem. He turned to Katzenberg and said, "Because it's not their movie anymore." Unfortunately, it didn't matter. Disney had seen enough. They shut down production on Toy Story and said they wouldn't resume until Pixar made major changes to the script. John Lasseter was embarrassed. He felt he'd let Steve Jobs and the entire company down. Steve was furious, but not at Lasseter or his own people. At Apple, Steve had often blamed any type of failure on his employees, but now Steve's loyalty to the Pixar team helped him see that they weren't the ones at fault. Steve didn't claim to be a filmmaker, but he thought it was obvious that Disney had steered the project in the wrong direction. Steve encouraged Lasseter and the Pixar animators to return to the story they'd intended to tell. And after months of rewrites, they transformed Woody into the lovable leader of the group of loyal toys at the center of the film. Eventually, Disney agreed to the changes, but there was a new problem. Because of the delay and the modifications to the film, Toy Story was now going to come in millions of dollars over budget. Steve believed that Disney was responsible for the mistakes, and they should pay for it. So when Disney demanded that Pixar cover the overage, Steve called Katzenberg and pressed his case. But Katzenberg wouldn't budge. The two men were at an impasse. But instead of flying into a rage as he might have done earlier in his career, Steve stepped back and let cooler heads prevail. He looked to Ed Catmull for help. Ed, who proved a calming presence even to the likes of Jeffrey Katzenberg, helped negotiate a compromise that both sides were happy with. And in 1994, Toy Story resumed production. Steve was excited to see the film come to life, but he was frustrated by how reliant Pixar was on Disney. As production on Toy Story wrapped, Steve committed himself to giving Pixar more leverage in their relationship with Disney. So he decided to take a bold risk and turn Pixar into a publicly traded company right after the release of Toy Story. If Pixar's initial public offering hit, the investment money would increase their worth exponentially. It would give Steve more leverage with Disney and would make him wealthier than he'd ever been before. But if nobody was willing to buy into Pixar and the stock fell flat, it would spell an end to Pixar and possibly Steve Jobs' career.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you-know-business.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's the spring of 1995 at John Lasseter's house in Sonoma, California. John and his wife have invited Steve and his wife, Laureen, for a weekend escape. Steve and John step out onto the porch to take in the view.
It's a beautiful spot, John, except for that monstrosity.
Steve points to a beat-up 1984 Honda Civic parked out front.
John, please tell me that's not what you're driving.
Yeah, it is.
What's on the seats?
T-shirts.
The seats are falling apart, so I put the shirts over them, make it a little more comfortable.
You drive this car to Pixar every day.
No, you can't do that. You have to get a new car.
I'm not in a position to buy a new car, Steve. This place costs us way more than we can afford.
Steve looks at Lasseter and shakes his head. The two men have become close friends over the past several years, and working together on Toy Story has brought them even closer. Steve wants to make sure Lasseter and everyone at Pixar is secure in their jobs and gets everything they deserve. But the company still isn't making money. Toy Story is set for release in November of 1995. Steve has to come up with a plan to use the film's release as a catalyst for the company's future success.
Well, John, I have a plan that a lot of people might say is crazy, but I believe in it. When Toy Story comes out, I want Pixar to go public. What do you think about that?
Steve, I have a BFA from CalArts. I don't know anything about taking any company public.
Steve gets excited at the chance to talk business with his friend. He talks to John well into the night about the process of taking a company public, preparing an IPO, what it means to have stockholders, the costs and risks of the decision, and more. John would later refer to it as his Business 101 class. But throughout, John has questions.
So, Steve, when you make a movie, you have to ask yourself, why? You have to ask why at every turn. Why does a character do this? Why does a character react in a certain way? Why does this event take place at this point in the film? Because chances are, if something doesn't work at the climax of a movie in Act 3, it's not because that moment was wrong. It's because you failed to answer a why question way back in Act 1. So what's your answer if I ask you, why take Pixar public now? Why?
Well, it could make a lot of people a lot of money.
But you've told me that's not the why behind why we're doing this. You'd be richer right now if you never poured money into Pixar. So let me ask again, why?
I want us to take some control back from Disney. If a public offering is successful, we could be in a position to fund a significant part of our own productions. If we bring more to the table, we have more leverage.
Okay.
And what if it's not successful? At some point, we have to take risks, John.
Do you believe in your movie?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I do too. I think it's going to be bigger than Disney realizes. I think it's going to make Pixar a household name. And if that happens, we can make something here that will outlive us. But we need money to do it.
Okay.
I think that's a good answer. But before we can do anything else, first, we have to take care of that car situation.
The two friends spend most of the night and the next day talking about the future of Pixar. Lasseter was nervous, but he trusted Steve, and he knew it was ultimately his decision to make. Steve made another decision. He included a bonus in Lasseter's paycheck with a note attached that said, "You have to use this to buy a new car. It has to be safe, and I have to approve it." Lasseter and his wife got a Volvo. Steve approved. From that point until the release of the movie, Steve tried to remain calm and patient. He would wait for Toy Story to reach the public and hope that Disney's marketing machine would do its job well enough to position Pixar for a strong IPO. As Toy Story's November release approached, Steve watched as Disney's press machine went into overdrive. Disney did everything in their power to build up hype around a new film that looked different than anything they had put out before. Disney also put themselves front and center in the story of the creation of this historic movie.
For anyone who's ever wondered what toys do when people aren't around.
Hey, everybody, it's showtime.
Walt Disney Pictures invites you into a world where toys come to life.
Wow, cool. Let's go to my room, guys.
Red alert, Andy is coming upstairs.
Andy's coming, everybody. Back to your places, hurry.
Did you see my ears?
Go and and beyond!
Walt Disney Pictures presents the first ever computer animated motion picture.
We've got trouble.
Toy Story.
As the hype around Toy Story grew, John Lasseter crossed his fingers and hoped the movie would live up to what Steve had come to expect. For his part, Steve's faith in the movie hadn't wavered. In fact, with each new little tweak to the film, Steve got more excited, and he brought that excitement with him when he worked behind the scenes on Pixar's IPO. Steve knew it was a risk, but he thought it was the only way to secure Pixar's financial future. Toy Story would hit theaters in late November, and it would take only a week for Steve's bold risk to pay off. On November 22, 1995, Toy Story went into wide release and crushed box office expectations. The movie hauled in $30 million in its opening weekend, far more than it cost to make. Toy Story would go on to gross $192 million domestically in its initial release and would bring in over $360 million worldwide. Toy Story would eventually become the top-grossing film of the year. Steve Jobs was riding high after Toy Story's release. He felt like all of the struggles he and Pixar had gone through had finally paid off. But there was one thing that bothered him. In early reviews, film critics gave the credit to Disney. They talked about how Toy Story was now part of the great Disney tradition. Steve immediately went on the offensive. He gave interviews and hammered home the fact that Toy Story was a Pixar film. Steve made it sound like Disney was little more than a distributor for the movie. He said Toy Story marked the emergence of Pixar, and he compared it to when Disney had entered the animation feature world with the release of Snow White in 1937. Hearing these comments, a number of people at Disney, including CEO Michael Eisner, thought Steve was petty and egotistical. But Steve was also being strategic. Of course, he wanted his company and his team to get the credit he thought they deserved, but there's more to Steve's PR push than that. Steve needed to convince investors that Pixar wasn't just a freelance animation house. He wanted them to see that Pixar was the animation company of the future. His strategy worked. On November 29, 1995, Pixar stock first entered the market at $22 per share. Within 30 minutes, shares skyrocketed to $45, over double. Pixar was such a hot stock that trading on it had to be suspended for a time. At one point in the day, Pixar stock reached a staggering $49 per share. Eventually, it settled and closed at $39. But this was still far bigger than Steve had ever imagined. Pixar had become the biggest IPO of the year. By the end of its first day of trading, only 7 days after Toy Story went into wide release, the little graphics company Steve had bought from George Lucas as a side project had turned Steve into a billionaire. For those who had already written Steve off, his emergence as an entertainment mogul was shocking. Steve had truly found the next big thing. It just wasn't a computer of the future. And if anyone doubted it, Steve had a fresh $1.2 billion to help make his case. But as Steve had told John Lasseter, he didn't go public with Pixar just to increase his personal wealth. He did it to secure the company's future and to put them in a stronger position to deal with Disney. The way Steve saw it, the successful IPO now gave him some much-needed leverage, and Steve wanted Disney to come back to the table and renegotiate their deal. The first point Steve wanted to make with Disney was about funding and profit. Disney had completely funded the production of Toy Story because Pixar had no money to make the movie. But with their new financial situation, Steve believed Pixar could fund 50% of its next several films. This meant instead of a 12.5 cut of box office, they could split it down the middle. But getting a bigger cut of the box office wasn't Steve's only goal for Pixar. He'd watched Jeffrey Katzenberg and the Disney team exercise creative power over John Lasseter and Pixar's animators during the filmmaking process. And Steve had also witnessed Disney's marketing team try to claim sole credit for Toy Story in ads and trailers. Steve didn't want either of those things to ever happen again with a Pixar movie. He wanted Pixar to have equal branding and messaging with Disney, and he was ready to fight for it. Steve made it clear that he knew Pixar had far more power in the relationship now than they had before Toy Story. He said if Disney wanted to benefit from Pixar's creative team and take part in the future of animated films, they'd have to renegotiate the terms. For their part, Disney was willing to meet with Steve, but Jeffrey Katzenberg had left the company and gone on to form DreamWorks with Steven Spielberg and David Geffen. So now, instead of Katzenberg, Steve would have to deal with Disney CEO Michael Eisner. Steve's self-confidence was high after Pixar's recent success, and he believed in what his company was doing. But he knew Eisner had a reputation as a tough negotiator. Steve knew if Eisner didn't see a benefit for Disney, he wouldn't give an inch. Steve would soon head down to Southern California to meet with Eisner face to face. From the start, things would get heated, and Eisner would do everything in his power to resist Steve and Pixar. But Steve would take the lessons he'd learned from his time at Pixar to nail down a deal that would cement his company's place in the movie business and make Steve one of the most powerful men in Hollywood. It's early 1996 at a restaurant in Burbank, California. Steve Jobs has flown in for a lunch meeting with Disney CEO Michael Eisner. Steve wants Eisner to agree to a new deal between Disney and Pixar. But so far, neither of them can seem to agree on anything. Do you hear yourself, Steve? The audacity it takes to make a demand like that. We want co-branding with Disney. I don't think that's out of line. I think it's the only thing that makes sense. We have a three-picture deal, Steve, and you're trying to undo it after only making one movie. Well, the situation has changed, Michael, and you're foolish if you can't see that. The situation may have changed, but the contract hasn't, Steve. Okay, then Pixar honors the three-movie deal. And as soon as it's over, we go somewhere else. Katzenberg, Spielberg, and Geffen need animated features. And I like Katzenberg. He and I already have a relationship. Steve thinks he's played this perfectly. He knows Jeffrey Katzenberg's departure from Disney was ugly. And he knows it had a lot to do with personal animosity between Katzenberg and Eisner. But Eisner is prepared, too. Okay, Steve, fine. Let's say after our deal wraps up, you take Pixar over to DreamWorks. Disney still maintains the rights to make sequels to Toy Story. We'll take Buzz, Woody, and all of the other characters, spin them off into a series of films, and Pixar will have no creative say in any of it. For a split second, Steve Jobs has a moment of crisis. The old version of Steve might have blown this off if it meant he could still walk away from Disney down the road. But the new Steve thinks about John Lasseter. He knows Lasseter looks at the Toy Story characters almost like they're his own children. If Disney took them over and cut Pixar out, it would break Lasseter's heart. Michael, this all started because you were desperate to have John Lasseter come work for you. And you were desperate, and still are, because your people can't make Pixar films. And you know it. Oh, please, Toy Story is a Disney movie. We paid for it, we shaped the story, we marketed it, we made it what it is. That's something you could tell yourself. Yeah, you can tell yourself that all you want, but it's crap. Pixar is the future of animated movies. Disney can either be a part of it or watch from the sidelines. Steve, you've had one hit. You need to come back to me when you've been doing this for decades. I'm confident Pixar is going to continue to grow, and I think you understand that we have something Disney wants. But I also know the benefits that come from working with Disney. I want Pixar to garner the same type of trust from consumers that you have. But if people are going to trust Pixar, they need to know we're making the movies. That's all there is to it. And I won't back down on that. For his part, Eisner sees the potential in maintaining a long-term relationship with Pixar. He knows if Toy Story is any indication, Pixar does have the ability to turn out massive hits with characters that can be easily merchandised. That could mean a lot of money for Disney. So Eisner gives a little. Okay, Steve, so what are you asking for here? Co-branding with Disney and an even split of the box office? Yes, co-branding with the movies, advertising, and toys. The toys. Well, we both know the toys take these movies to a different level. Toy Story is the beginning of a revolution, and Disney helped start it. Don't miss out on where it goes from here. This lunch was the first of several meetings between Steve Jobs and Michael Eisner. And it was the first step towards a new deal between their two companies. Steve left feeling good. He had accomplished what he had set out to do. He clearly demonstrated Pixar's worth to Eisner. And eventually, Pixar and Disney would nail down an agreement that would give Steve the co-branding and profit share he wanted. Steve's journey with Pixar had taught him valuable lessons and helped him grow into a different kind of leader. He used his time working with the Pixar creatives to expand his views on motivation and self-awareness. At Apple and at Next, he intended to make bold demands that couldn't be met. It was part of the reality distortion filter his colleague and confidant Joanna Hoffman had criticized him for. At Pixar, Steve still made bold demands and pushed his employees, but he also recognized where and when he needed to adjust his expectations. He could also see where certain people excelled, and he would give them the space and support they needed to do their best work. Ed Catmull said that he always believed Steve wanted to grow and change, even if he wouldn't admit it. At Pixar, Steve had avoided many of the mistakes he had made at Next, and he was worlds away from the young man who had run the Macintosh team back at Apple. Still, in spite of his success at Pixar, Apple was never far from Steve's mind. Not long after Pixar's IPO, Steve would receive an unexpected phone call that would change the trajectory of his career and lure him back to the very company that had driven him out. By 1996, Apple was in trouble. Years of mediocre products, ineffective leadership, and a lack of innovation had made Apple increasingly irrelevant in the computer industry. The situation was so dire that Bill Gates had ended his relationship with the company. Watching from the sidelines, Steve blamed John Sculley, the same man who had forced him out. Steve believed Sculley and his associates had only cared about making money, not making great products. And at least some people at Apple agreed. The company had moved on from Sculley in 1993, and they had hoped a change in leadership would turn things around. But the man who had replaced Sculley, Michael Spindler, didn't fare much better. Spindler had tried to sell Apple to Sun, HP, and even IBM, but he had no luck. Spindler didn't spend much time at the top, and Apple desperately sought out a leader who could right the ship. They hoped that man was Gil Amelio. Amelio had stepped in as Apple CEO in February of 1996. He inherited a company in dire straits. Money was scarce, the staff had been drastically cut, and the company had very little to offer consumers. Before Amelio's tenure, Apple had tried to build a new operating system that would update its old Mac operating system to compete with Microsoft Windows 95. But again, the product was mediocre, and Amelio believed it would never be commercially viable. Amelio also believed if Apple couldn't create its own operating system, he would have to look outside the company for help. Desperate to save Apple and keep his position, Amelio came up with a radical idea. In the fall of 1996, he walked into a staff meeting and said he had the solution to the operating system problem. Apple would partner with Next. Amelio then asked if anyone knew Steve Jobs well enough to pick up the phone and call him. When Steve got the call from Apple, he didn't hesitate. He said he would gladly meet with Amelio to discuss the proposal. But even before Steve hung up the phone, his wheels were turning. Almost immediately, Steve began formulating a plan that would redeem Next's image, restore Apple to its former glory, and give Steve a chance to once again build the next big thing. Next on Business Movers, Steve Jobs returns to Apple and revolutionizes the company by applying lessons from the past, looking beyond computers and introducing a new product that will forever change the way people consume music, the iPod. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Business Movers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. From Wondery, this is episode 2 of The Enlightenment of Steve Jobs for Business Movers. A quick note about our dramatizations. In most cases, we can't know everything that happened, but all our reenactments are based on historical research. If you'd like to learn more about Steve Jobs, we recommend Steve Jobs by Walter Isaacson, Becoming Steve Jobs by Brent Schlender and Rick Tetzeli, The Business Wisdom of Steve Jobs, edited by Alan Ken Thomas, and I, Steve Jobs in His Own Words, edited by George Bean. Business Movers is hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Audio editing by Molly Bach. Sound design by Derek Behrens. Music by Lindsey Graham. This episode is written and researched by Michael Federico. Executive producers are Stephen Walters for Ritual Productions and Jenny Lauer-Beckman and Marsha Louie for Wondery.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.